Adolf Hitler didn't have nuclear weapons. Adolf Hitler didn't have the possibility of destroying the world through catastrophic climate change. And being willing to use a madman strategy in an era of thermonuclear weapons is extraordinarily dangerous, especially when you have an ally, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose political survival is tied with permanent war, and today with a war against Iran, which he's desperately trying to restart.
Hi, I'm Matt Ho, a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Media Institute, and I'll be guest hosting Deep Focus this month. This month alone, President Donald Trump has told reporters after attending the NBA Finals in New York on June 8th that a deal to end the war with Iran could be reached in 2 or 3 days, and that the Strait of Hormuz would reopen immediately after such a deal. He said the two sides are in the final stages of a very, very good deal that will not in any way allow nuclear weapons. We should note that Donald Trump has said similar things about the proximity of a deal about 37 times since the ceasefire began in early April. Part of the original ceasefire deal was that Israel would end the invasion of Lebanon. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Monday that the war against Iran and Hezbollah has not yet ended, insisting both are weaker than ever. The fragile so-called ceasefire frayed over the weekend as Iran and Israel traded strikes for the first time since it came into effect in mid-April. 2 days later, the loss of an American Apache helicopter led to the most serious exchange of fire between the U.S. and Iran since the ceasefire began. Today, we are going to talk all about this with Dr. Thomas Reifer, professor and chair of sociology at the University of San Diego, California. In a recent article in the Global Policy Journal titled "The Unfolding World War, The Political Uses of Madness, and the Fate of Republics," Dr. Reifer argues that we are in a new age where leaders, particularly Donald Trump, deliberately employ a madman strategy of projected irrationality, which makes increasingly reckless gambles with human lives. Dr. Reifer is also an affiliated faculty in ethnic studies, Latin American studies, women and gender studies, and the Kroc School of Peace Studies. He is, as well, an associate fellow at the Transnational Institute, a worldwide fellowship of committed scholar activists. Dr. Reifer's specialty is the study of large-scale, long-term social changes in world system analysis. In 2023, he co-authored with Carlton D. Floyd, The American Dream and Dreams Deferred, a dialectical fairy tale. Tom Reifer, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Great to meet you.
I want to begin, Tom, with one of the foundational aspects of your essay. And I just want to say that the title of that essay, "The Unfolding World War, The Political Uses of Madness and the Fate of the Republics," I think that really has grabbed the storyline here. But one of the foundational aspects of that essay is the work of Dan Ellsberg, someone that you knew well, worked with. Dan, of course, the greatest American whistleblower. You know, Dan passed away 3 years ago, but a posthumous book of Dan's was published this year called "Truth and Consequence: Reflections on Catastrophe, Civil Resistance, and Hope." And you helped work on that book. And Dan's work is really reflected in your essay in the Global Policy Journal. So I just want to begin by asking you, Tom, how did Dan Ellsberg influence your understanding of the world, how leaders make decisions, and why it seems that these wars of aggression become stalemated and then eventually lead to other wars?
Well, ironically, I met Dan when I was 16 years old on January 9th, 1984, in a class he was teaching at University of California, Irvine, as a UC Regents lecturer called "Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy." And in that class, he talked about, on the first day, Nixon's strategy to end the Vietnam War by threatening the use of nuclear weapons and specifically making it appear to the Vietnamese that he was crazy. He said, "I call it the madman theory, Bob," to his to Bob Haldeman's chief of staff. And there's a new film out it called The President and the Moratorium, or The Madman and the Moratorium, about Nixon's strategy of appearing to be mad to try to get the Vietnamese to settle on terms acceptable to the U.S. And so I remember him talking about those lectures that he gave in the 1950s called "The Political Uses of Madness." This was when Khrushchev was making threats, which were largely bluffs because he didn't have the nuclear weapons, but he pretended he did because he was operating from an inferior position. So he used to say, Khrushchev, were churning out missiles like sausages, which was actually false. But unfortunately, it played into the fears of the Cold War in the U.S. at a time when Dan was a true believer. So come to 2026, I come across an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal saying Trump may be nearing his Nixon moment. And then I find out that the Iranians have been planning for a war since the 12-day war in June. And the code name for their war plan, which they're now implementing, is called Operation Madman. So it's not just Trump, but it's also the Iranians who've been backed into a corner. And what have they got to lose? So if you look at what they're doing and it seems crazy and it seems mad, well, yeah, people can adopt that as a strategy. Trump himself today is back to the madman strategy, saying that the Iranians are going to pay for dragging on the negotiations at the same time as his vice president saying we're close to a deal.
Right. So when you write in your essay that Donald Trump is appearing unstable, he's unpredictable and quite possibly mad, and then we throw back and remember Nixon's strategy in the Vietnam War, that's not coincidence, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And it is the case that Donald Trump is unpredictable, but he also is consciously adopting this strategy of trying to appear crazy. So, for example, in his April 7th threat to annihilate Iranian civilization, April 7th happens to be Dan's birthday. So
it's actually my birthday, too. That's one of the great things. Oh, yeah, wow. I shared a birthday with Dan Ellsberg, which
amazing. There was a real question of whether the U.S. or the Israelis would possibly use nuclear weapons. Now, I don't rule that out from any moral standpoint, in the sense that Netanyahu and Trump, what do they care? They don't have a moral transgression that would be unacceptable to them. In fact, Trump later on said they reached this agreement, this temporary ceasefire on April 7th. But later on, Trump said that he was totally serious. He was willing to do it. So he has put himself out there as somebody who will stop at nothing to get what he wants. And look at his threats about Greenland. He said that he decided that he wasn't going to take over Greenland. He didn't say he couldn't do it. In fact, when the New York Times interviewed him and said, is there anything that restrains you? He said, yes, my own morality. What about international law? I don't need international law. I'm not looking to hurt anybody.
Right. And I just want to go back to what you mentioned just before, though, about Iran and that they're pursuing their old man, you know, their old man. And so if you could elaborate on that, Tom.
Well, one, so the Iranians felt sure, and they were right, that after the 12-day war in June, that the U.S. and Israel were going to attack again. And they prepared as to what they were going to do if Khomeini was assassinated and other people were assassinated. They have a very strong repressive bureaucratic regime. And they basically said, if we're faced with this existential risk, we will attack other countries in the Gulf. Trump said, who could have imagined they would have done that? Well, Khomeini sent a tweet in English so everybody could see, telling him exactly what they're going to do. But Netanyahu convinced Trump that this would be just like Venezuela. They'd go in there, they declare this victory. They were trying to sell the war plan, just like the U.S. was trying to sell the Iraq war in the midterm elections in 2002. So they didn't talk about the potential problems. So the Iranians are acting recklessly mad, but also entirely predictable for a regime that's been pressed to the wall. And what strategic analysts say, this is a much more, this is a regime in Iran that is much more aggressive, much more willing to take risks. The strategic equation has changed, and this can be seen by their responding to an attack, Israeli attack on Beirut, by supporting Hezbollah and launching missiles against Israel. So in fact, what we have is we didn't overthrow the regime. We have a much more aggressive, unpredictable regime. That's what this war has produced.
Right. But even too, before this regime, the top leadership was annihilated, assassinated in end of February, early March, they were pursuing, you know, what would fall into the context of a madman strategy. Absolutely. But they were deliberate, absolutely, though, right? So essentially, you can look, yeah, at what's happening right now as essentially a game of economic warfare chicken, whose economy is going to collapse first. But in a sense of the Americans, would you say it was reckless to pursue this because there wasn't planning and preparation while the Iranians did deliberately prepare for this?
Well, two things. Of course, this was a war of aggression, a classic war of aggression as defined at Nuremberg as the supreme international crime, which embodied the evil, the accumulated evil of the whole. So the United States and Israel violated international law, violated the Nuremberg Doctrine, by launching this war of aggression. It didn't work out as they planned. And because they basically got into an escalating stalemate, now they're trying to use the threat of appearing mad. The problem with that, in addition to the moral questions you can raise about it, is that it can fail. And then you're in a dilemma. Do you look like you're bluffing? And by the way, Trump's press secretary says something that's not true, but she says Trump doesn't bluff. Actually, the word bluff is not really clear. We don't have a word in English to say that you're doing something that you don't intend to carry out, but you might carry out. It just is a bluff, or you mean to do it. But in fact, lots of times people make threats, which they might carry out, but maybe they won't. It's uncertain. And in fact, Dan's work on uncertainty, which revolutionized the field of decision making, was about exactly that. You're looking at things that are uncertain. Will Trump act on his threats because he didn't act on it before? Well, you can just look at the example of Putin. Putin's people said, well, Putin, he's not that risky. He won't invade Ukraine. But then he did. So people's ideas change.
You know, and I want to get back to your essay, Tom, because you get into all of this in really great detail. And again, the essay is called The Unfolding World War: The Political Uses of Madness and the Fate of Republics, and that's in the Global Policy Journal. And you quote Dan Ellsberg. You take from this recently released book and note that Dan said, important things not sufficiently recognized or conceptualized, risk-taking, gambles, and threats, and the avoidance of humiliation, failure, blame, and reproach. So we've spoken a bit about how the risk-taking, the gambling, the aggression, right, can lead to places that are unpredictable, where the consequences are unintended. But what about this second point here? How the avoidance of humiliation, the avoidance of failure, do you don't want to be blamed or considered weak? How does that affect leadership and decision-making and strategy?
Excellent question. Well, Dan came up with something that very few people recognize he came up with, and he came up with it while he was reading the Pentagon Papers. Remember that people had given an image of decision-making that the U.S. kind of got into Vietnam little by little. They didn't understand the risks, so on and so forth. The Pentagon Papers showed that that was false. The presidents were not told that what they would do would be successful. They were told the opposite. So from a decision-making standpoint, it was very puzzling. Why did they do it? And Dan came up with a notion called the desperate proposal pattern, which was later kind of verified in some ways by the work of Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for his work with Ammon Tversky. When people are facing a short-term risk of losing, humiliation, or failure, especially when it comes to leaders, they are willing to take desperate gambles to win or to come out even. And remember, for Trump, the worst word in his vocabulary is loser. Now, okay, if you look at his history, he's a total loser. He basically bankrupted himself time and time again. He bankrupted all his enterprises, but he came to power as a kind of demagogue and a con man, presenting himself as the great negotiator. Well, he started a war, and now the strait is closed, and he tore up the JCPOA, which was preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons, so he's in a real bind. And I don't think, even though it's obvious that he wants to find an exit strategy and way to end the war, I don't assume that he won't at some point make good on his threats to vastly escalate the war if he can't get what he wants. And this is a pattern of behavior. You also see it in Netanyahu. Netanyahu does not want to end the war because he's facing an election in which he's now losing in the polls. In fact, it was interesting because Trump just the other day said, I don't know if Netanyahu is going to run again. Well, of course he's going to run again. But I think maybe that may be a message to Netanyahu that you're dispensable. The problem is that you have three groups of leaders that are really in a bind right now. The Iranians, who are pressed to the wall, Trump, who's pressed to the wall, and Netanyahu. Don't assume that they will back down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And none of this is new, though. We keep coming back to, as you just said, it's a pattern. And, you know, when people ask me over the years, when people ask me, hey, Matt, what are the best books to read about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq? I always say, read Neil Shaheen's book, A Bright Shining Lie, and David Halberstam's book, The Best and the Brightest. And those two books about Vietnam, I said, if you read those books about Vietnam, you will understand America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I don't know if we necessarily need to go back to Vietnam, but say, just let's keep ourselves in the Middle East. You know, over the last 30 years, 40 years, maybe starting point can be Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, right? But can you just basically walk us through this pattern, how these wars of aggression become stalemated, and then they lead to more conflict?
Well, the 1982 invasion of Lebanon and the Israelis moving into Beirut is an excellent example, because there, the primary reason why the Israelis went in was not the threat of war, it was the threat of peace. It was the fact that the Palestinian Liberation Organization was getting lots of support, and they didn't want to go to what had become the internationally accepted solution, the two-state solution. So they went into Lebanon in a classic war of aggression. And what did they get out of it? They got an 18-year occupation and the creation of Hezbollah. So one of the reasons why the current war is so complex is that you have early wars of aggression which have compounded the problem. There is no military solution to the problem. And the problem is all bound up with the almost next year, it'll be the 60th year of Israelis' military occupation of East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza, which they got as a result of their attack in the 1967 war. This is an occupation which is all funded for and paid for by the United States, despite the fact that there's overwhelming international support for a two-state solution. In September 2025, the UN voted overwhelmingly in favor of a two-state solution. There's also the question of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Okay, you don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons in the Middle East? Fine, support a nuclear-free zone. But we can't do that because the U.S. and Israel won't admit what everybody knows, which is that the Israelis have nuclear weapons.
You know, and I want to talk, you know, more broadly, you know, because this what you're talking about here, this madman strategy, this irrationality, this inability to accept the idea of failing. Right. And you're being blamed for failing, being seen as weak. That's just not confined to the Americans and their wars. Right. That's other places. Absolutely. I do want to touch before we go to there. I want to talk about nuclear weapons. And I want to talk about nuclear war, because folks watching, you may be sitting there thinking, this is happening 8,000 miles away. It doesn't really affect me. But of course, the fact that there are roughly 14,000 nuclear weapons in the world right now, I think. But, you know, essentially it does affect us here. It does impact us. And I want to go back to a quote you have again from Dan Ellsberg in your essay, where you cite this from Dan, where Dan says, every action creates a new context for going further. There is an incentive not to back down, not to admit failure, error, or wrong tactics. Instead, there can be a temptation to believe that more force will succeed, that the enemy is near the edge, near a breaking point. Further risks arise from command and control failures, the breakdown of controls in the field, and the fog of war. There are unthinkable thoughts in the White House, but nuclear threats and nuclear wars are not among them. However, surrender is.
Yes. So there's two things.
I mean, this is horrifying, right? This is absolutely horrifying.
Yes. So one is that leaders do use nuclear weapons. The idea that we haven't used nuclear weapons since 1945 is simply false. We use them all the time, every day sometimes, by threatening their use. That's why leaders buy them. That's why leaders get them. And that's what they've been doing in this conflict. And of course, you have two actors that have the potential to use nuclear weapons. you have the United States, and you have Israel. The other idea is that leaders think that they have control. Well, they don't have control. There's the fog of war. Things happen. As George Ball said on Vietnam, quoting Emerson, things are in the saddle and ride mankind. So the idea that you control the pattern of escalation is a big myth. Things can get out of control. And just look at Ukraine right now. Of course, you have a war of aggression carried out by Putin in the context of NATO expansion, in violation of the U.S. explicit promises to Gorbachev that we wouldn't expand NATO east. You have this condemnable war by Putin, terrible bombing of the Ukrainians responding by bombing St. Petersburg and Moscow, and now in the last month, a major exercise of forces by Putin, including simulating the use of nuclear weapons, including with nuclear weapons. Now, that is a very worrisome situation. So the listeners may be surprised to know, if I've been asking my friends, do you know the name of the U.S. ambassador to Moscow? They say, no, there is no U.S. ambassador to Moscow. There hasn't been a U.S. ambassador to Moscow for over a year. Trump uses his best friend, real estate buddy, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who have business deals, which are a conflict of interest, to do these trips to Pakistan and do these trips to Russia. You can't do this, as Aaron David Miller said, a former State Department, worked at the State Department, advised six secretaries of state, and also was in the State Department's INR. You can't do these deals like it's a real estate transaction on the back of a napkin. And you have to care. This president doesn't really care. As he said recently, he finds it boring.
Yeah, and can you, Tom, can you go a little more into this use of Witkoff and Kushner? Because I think it really befuddles people around the world.
So this is an example of total corruption. And think about the following thing. For the first time since Henry Kissinger, you have a Secretary of State who's also the National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio. Where is Marco Rubio? Nobody knows where Marco Rubio is. What is he doing? Instead, you have Trump's best friend, Steve Witkoff, who has business interests all throughout the Middle East, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, same thing. So they're negotiating in Ukraine, and they're saying, well, if we end the war, our corporations will be responsible for half of the cleanup. It's total corruption. They're interested in making money. In fact, listeners should know the following thing. When Trump says, he said, 38 times that the war is going to end, and then military stocks go down and oil stocks go down, the folks that hold his money then buy up those stocks. So basically, they're making enormous amounts of money on the war, and they don't appear to care that much about it. Otherwise, you would think that they would have an ambassador to Moscow, but then it's not totally directly in the president's control. So this combination of corruption and imperial arrogance and ignorance is just really flabbergasting. And that's why the vote in the Congress to hold Trump to the War Powers Act and the potential upcoming vote in the Senate is so important. Congress is that body that has the power to declare war by the Constitution. And that was an idea that the founders had that was a good idea. And one of the things I quote in my piece is John Adams, when he was Secretary of State in 1821, his 4th of July speech, America, she goes not in search of monsters to destroy, and his warnings about what would happen if we did go in search of monsters to destroy.
You know, this aspect of Kushner and Witkoff, it's part of this overall madman. I don't want to call it a strategy, because as you're explaining, it's not a strategy. It's reality, right? We're dealing with a mad president here, a mad king, a mad emperor.
Yes. And the Arms Control Association called it a madman without a strategy.
Right. And so with Nixon, who goes to China, who's got, say what you will about Henry Kissinger and all his war crimes, I don't think anyone would say that Henry Kissinger was not an international relations professional. Ronald Reagan, with all his bluster and his rhetoric and his denunciations of the evil empire and arms buildup, he still went and met with Gorbachev and brought about, world-changing arms control. You don't see any possibility of that here. So if you are the Chinese, Tom. If you are the Russians, you are the Iranians, you're the Europeans. And dealing with, you know, I just saw Governor Landry's name pop up again, Governor Landry of Louisiana, who is Donald Trump's special envoy or representative or czar or whatever they're calling him for Greenland. You know, that's why his name just right. pop up again in the last week or two. So if you're any of America's adversaries or allies, how do you deal with this?
Very hard to do, although there is one area where Trump announced a potential new era of international cooperation. He said he wants to cooperate with Xi Jinping and Putin on going against the International Criminal Court. I mean, here's the problem we have. People talk about Hitler, who was genuinely, actually, that's the thing that the listeners should know. Dan's political uses of madness was modeled especially on Hitler's threats before World War II. So this strategy has been tried before. It's partly worked before, but it's also ended in total disaster. Now let's look at Trump. What is he doing? He's maximizing the possibility of destroying the world. He says climate change is a hoax. He just put $700 million into firing up coal plants. He's fighting a war for oil, not just in Iran, but of course in Venezuela. He wants to control it. So this is a person who, by any standard of substantive rationality, is truly mad. But David Hume had a different definition of rationality. The famous philosopher, he said, 'tis not unreasonable if I prefer the destruction of the world to the scratching of my finger. I mean, if those are your preferences, you can act consistently on that. Well, what are Donald Trump's preferences? Donald Trump's preferences is to be seen as being in charge of the world. So a few years ago, he gave an interview to The Atlantic. He said, I control the U.S. and I control the world. Well, he doesn't. Okay. But the idea that he wants to is a scary thought, given his intention. And remember, what did he say about Greenland? He said, well, I wasn't given the Nobel Peace Prize, so I now no longer have to think purely in terms of peace. This is a person who is far more dangerous than the limited technological ability, as evil as he was, as Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler didn't have nuclear weapons. Adolf Hitler didn't have the possibility of destroying the world through catastrophic climate change. And being willing to use a madman strategy in an era of thermonuclear weapons is extraordinarily dangerous, especially when you have an ally, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose political survival is tied with permanent war, and today with a war against Iran, which he's desperately trying to restart.
You know, and
Please, Tom. So I think that what needs to happen in the U.S. and the rest of the world is we have to say, look, international law has been limited in terms of its applicability, in terms of the countries being able to follow it. But at least before, the United States rhetorically didn't say they didn't care about it at all whatsoever. Even in practice, they didn't. And we have to say the law of the jungle is worse than a rule where you have the rule of law, including a rule of law that says you can't invade other countries. We should pressure the United States to be part of the International Criminal Court and also allow them to take up the crime of aggression.
Now, how does this then factor all into the changing world? You know, there's a lot of commentary. I like to describe this war with Iran as a war of the 20th century versus the 21st century, a war of the American imperial order versus the multipolar world, that this is a transitory or transformational war, at least as how the historians will, you know, demarcate the passage of this.
Yes.
Right. And so how does this irrationality then, if you're the president of the United States and you are in command of a declining empire, how does this irrationality become institutionalized, essentially?
Well, that is really the key question, because in some ways, Trump is a fantasist. And his primary fantasy is to say to Americans that that the United States is just as powerful and, in fact, more powerful than ever. And therefore, to try to resist decline rather than manage it gracefully and try to build up an international order where people have respect for the rule of law. And Trump, on the one hand, says contradictory things. He says, America is a third world country. It's a train wreck. We're totally ruled. but we have infinite power to do whatever we want. Now, that's a recipe for total global disaster, which is the direction that we're heading. We're heading in a world where there's no rules, there's no international law, unless it's stopped by domestic political pressure and international pressure to go back to a world in which there's rules for everybody. You can't have the United States say, the other day they criticized the Russians for bombing Ukraine, which they should have done. But the U.S. telling the Russians to uphold international law? How can we tell the Russians to uphold international law when the United States and Israel refuse to do so?
Or you see Marco Rubio complaining how the United Nations isn't doing its job opening up the Straits of Hormuz, right? I don't know if it's self-awareness. Is it just hypocrisy? Is it just wooden-headedness?
Total lack of self-reflexivity and awareness, right? So Trump says we don't need any allies. We may invade Greenland. And then he asks his allies to help us.
Well, hey, let's go to the allies then, because one of the most poignant parts of your essay, and people can find the essay in the Global Policy Journal. Again, he titled it "The Unfolding World War: The Political Uses of Madness and the Fate of Republics." But towards the end of the essay, you referenced the philosopher Jürgen Habermas and his understanding of where the Europeans, America's allies, treaty allies, are going with respect to their own irrationality, to their own embracer of aggression or of war as a means to not just, defend or advance their interests, but to protect their identity, if you will.
So I'm glad you mentioned that. So Jürgen Habermas was one of the most famous philosophers of the post-World War II era. He grew up in Nazi Germany and realized that he was part of a criminal state, which had launched these wars of aggression, destroyed European Jewry. By the way, there wasn't enough attention of the fact that they also killed up to 20 million Soviet citizens and killed over 3 million Soviet prisoners of war. But in the context of anti-communism, that was just let go. What Habermas said is that Ukraine has a right to defend itself against Russian aggression. But what he was worried about is that this cavalier attitude toward the reappearance of world war and the lack of any plan for a negotiated settlement. People have to realize that we're in a world of thermonuclear weapons. So the question isn't just what is right. It's also the question of balancing what is right with not blowing up the world. If the world blows up, that doesn't help the Ukrainians. The fact is, and this is hard for people to hear, the likelihood of Ukrainians getting back Crimea and some of its territories varies very small. How are you going to do that? How are you going to force the Russians to do that without blowing up the world? Okay, that's unjust. Everybody recognizes that. But you have to realize that the Ukrainian bombing of Moscow and St. Petersburg, putting aside the question of civilians, however much you might say, well, because the Russians are bombing them, that's a proportional response. I'm not saying it is, but you could say that. But you're bombing a country that has thermonuclear weapons, which Putin is threatening to use. Now, people say, well, he's threatened it so many times, he's not really going to do it. Well, what if you're wrong? Shouldn't it be something we could be concerned about? We have to settle these conflicts in a way where there's a solution that's just, and we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Well, you also have the very real danger here that when you have nations like Ukraine or Israel that want to see support come in, Ukraine wants to see the Europeans do more, the Americans come back, or the Israelis, of course, want to see the war with Iran restarted for their purposes, get the Americans back in, you provoke it, right? So with regards to Ukraine, you provoke Russia to do more, and that, the idea goes, would then present the opportunity for the Europeans to do more, to put it politely. But, you know, we've only got time for one more question, and you touched on it briefly. I want to go back to it, though. And you end your essay with this. What do we do about it? I mean, what do we do about all this? What's to be done?
I think in the United States, there needs to be maximum pressure on Congress, specifically the Senate, to vote for the Wars Powers Resolution, and there should be a movement building to pressure the United States to have an acceptable solution to this war, which the U.S. and Israel started illegally, going into the midterm elections. We should support candidates who are willing to say this war was illegal. It was wrong. We have to go back to the ideas of the founders about giving Congress that war power. And we have to get a Congress in the House and the Senate that's willing to take back democratic control of foreign policy and push for the two-state solution in Israel-Palestine, which all these conflicts are entwined with. Unless you address that situation, the Middle East will forever be a cauldron which will spawn war after war after war. And simultaneously, we also need to push for a just negotiated solution to the war between Russia and Ukraine.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks, Tom, for joining us on Deep Focus. As a reminder, I'm guest hosting this month. Thank you, Tom, for being here today, for your insights. Dr. Thomas Reifer is the chair and professor of sociology at the University of San Diego. We'll add a link to his article, The Unfolding World War, The Political Uses of Madness and the Fate of Republics, in the Global Policy Journal. We'll put that link on this post. Reminder, please like, share, comment on this episode of Deep Focus, where we continue to bring you deep discussions on topics of the day. Thank you for watching and listening.
Thanks, Matthew, for all your work on behalf of peace and justice.